Same rules as the first quiz. I will let you know when the quizzes are done. I will put them out. If you want to pick them up, great. If you don't want to pick them up, I noticed about a half of quiz ones are still out there. So I'm going to take them back inside. It just gets chaotic out there. But I'll put the quiz twos out, alphabetical order, face down. And you can come pick them up whenever you know, if you want them. I'm not going to talk about the quiz. I mean, right now you can, you know, let it simmer in the background, put it away, because I want to finish up the last few pieces of investment analysis. Now, we've talked about side costs and side benefits. And today I want to kind of finish up that side benefits part. So let me turn the lights down. It's a little too bright. So when we think about side benefits, a project provides side benefits. It can create additional revenues, reduce costs. And the bottom line is you got to bring them into the process. Collectively, this is what we talk about when we talk about synergies, things that you create for the rest of the company. And Disney is a perfect example of a company that kind of milks every project to get additional value, right? A movie succeeds, it creates a spin-off series now on streaming. It creates characters to go in the theme parks. It sells toys, merchandising. In fact, the rule for a Disney movie is it doesn't even have to make money at the gate to make money for Disney as a company. The side benefits are enough. So building on the theme, let's talk a little bit about bringing these synergies into the process. I'm going to start with a very simple example. Bookscape, that private bookstore. I mean, now if you go into any, there aren't that many bookstores left, but if you go into any of the chain bookstores, many of them have restaurants and cafes, but people just come and sit. I don't know what they do, but I don't even know whether they buy stuff, but they have cafes. So let's say Bookscape decides that it's going to put a cafe in because everybody else has one. Let me cut to the chase. Let's assume that if you look at the revenues and the cash flows of the cafe, the net present value you get is negative. Minus 87,571. So, you know, if you by itself, the cafe makes no sense. But here's why Bookscape is thinking about the cafe. It thinks that if people come in for the cafe, they'll buy something at the bookstore. So let's assume that because they have the cafe, this is an incremental effect, that the revenues of the bookstore will increase by 500,000 in year one, growing at 10% a year. So the side benefit is, these people buy more books. So the question we're asking is the present value of the cash flows you get from selling more books greater than that minus 87,000 you have for the cafe? So here's what I've done. I've projected out the income from the revenues, you know, looking at it after taxes. And that income is also going to be cash flow because there's really nothing else to kind of factor in there. So this is very similar to what you had on the case when you had side benefits from Lowe's opening, you know, furniture stores for the regular building supply stores. Bottom line is, if you take the present value, the synergy benefits, that present value exceeds the cost or the net present value, the negative net present value of the cafe, meaning that you'll still open the cafe, even though it's not a good standalone investment. Just one mechanical detail. When I computed the net present value of the cafe, I used a restaurant cost of capital. Why? Because it's a different business. But when I discount the synergy benefits because it's to the bookstore, I'm going to go back to a bookstore cost of capital. So that's one thing that we did in the case as well, juggling different costs of capital depending on where the benefits come from. So if there's nothing else you take out of this section, that's one thing that I hope you take out is when you look at a project, the discount rate to you should never be the company's discount rate automatically. Sometimes it'll work, but a discount rate that reflects the risk of the project. You notice this on the first question of the quiz, right? I gave you the company, I gave you the entertainment software business. I gave you the specifics of both. And by now it should almost be automatic. You go to the project, you get the characteristics of the project, and then you can bring in your company specifics. How do they plan to fund the project? Because that might still be the company's choice. Now, the other big project we looked at was Tata Motors' acquisition of Harman. If you remember, the value that I came up for Harman Audio based on its standalone valuation was about $2.5 billion. That was well below the actual stock price. So if you ask me, should I do this acquisition based on those numbers, it seems like a big negative net present value investment. But Tata Motors is doing this because they expect synergies. So let's flesh out what those synergies are. So let's assume that if by combining the two companies, you know, that you generate 10 billion rupees more in additional after-tax operating income starting in year four. Why am I waiting till year four? Because I've never believed synergies show up overnight. It takes a while for the companies to come together. So I'm building in the reality that you got to wait 3 years before it shows up. By itself, you're saying, who cares? There's a time value. So when I look at the value of synergies, it's going to start from year four, and I've given you what the synergy is. You know how difficult this is to actually get managers to put a number on? They don't want to put a number on synergy. Why? Because they'd prefer it to be this nice buzzword that you can use to justify the premium. Why do you pay 30% more? Synergy. Why do you pay 50% more? Synergy. I think your job and my job is essentially to, when managers use the word synergies, to push them. I think it makes both sides better off, because when you push for synergy to be quantified, what does it do? It puts numbers on a table. Once you have numbers on a table, you can hold people accountable for delivering those numbers. You know who I'd hold accountable? Every project has a project salesperson, right? Somebody's pushing for the project. They love the project. They want you to do the acquisition. So, okay, you want the acquisition to be done. You're talking about the synergy. Make your projections, and you're now going to be held accountable. You'll be amazed at how quickly those numbers will come down. Once they recognize that it's not just a buzzword that you throw in there or a number that you throw in there. But this is, I think, if you look at it, now there's a study, I think McKinsey did it, or maybe KPMG, across 10,000 mergers. And they came up with a depressing finding. In only one of six mergers did synergy actually show up. These were mergers where synergy was given as a motivation up front, but in only one of six did synergy actually show up. And then they took a deeper look at those companies to see what they shared in common. And the one thing they shared in common is these companies actually planned for synergy, actually had specific plans before they did the acquisition. So that's what we're pushing for. We're not trying to be the skunks of the party. You want to do an acquisition, you want to party, fine. You want to use the word synergy, that's okay. But we want to flesh out those numbers. So now I'm going to think about, how do I get the value of the synergy? And here again, I'm going to go back to the question of, what discount rate should I apply on synergy? The question I'd have to ask is, where does the synergy show up? It's showing up primarily in the Indian automobile part of the business, right? Basically, it's allowing Tata Motors to sell more cars because they now have much better audio systems. So to get the risk, I looked at the beta for Tata Motors that I estimated for the automobile business. If you remember, when I valued Harman Audio, I used the beta for, you know, electronics, because that's what it was in. But here, the additional sales are in automobiles. So I looked at the business risk for Tata Motors. Almost all of the additional revenues are going to show up in India. Why? Because Jaguar Land Rover already has really good sound systems. This is not going to help them that much. So the equity risk premium I'm going to use is going to be the Indian equity risk premium. And finally, for the debt ratio, based on what Tata Motors is pushing, I'm going to go back to the debt ratio of Tata Motors. So essentially, the cost of equity, the cost of debt, and cost of capital reflect where the synergies show up. So if you put those numbers together, the value that you get for the synergy is about 70.7 billion rupees. It still leaves me well below where I need to be to justify the acquisition. Sometimes taking managers at their word on synergy, putting the numbers in and coming back to them and saying, hey, I took everything you told me would happen. This is a best case scenario, but you're still way short of what you're paying. That, I think, is the way we hold people accountable. If you get a chance, do you remember when InBev were the world's largest brewer, but SAB Miller, the second largest brewer in the world? I never understood how antitrust never stopped in there, right? Biggest brewer by the second biggest brewer. It's a huge acquisition. When it happened, I started with the presumption that InBev knows what it's doing, that it must be getting a bargain. You know why? Who controls InBev? I mean, it's a publicly traded company, but it's actually controlled by a Brazilian group called 3G Capital. Have you heard of these guys? They're considered among the shrewdest cost cutters on the face of the earth. They're incredibly ruthless. In fact, they bought Modelo 3 years before they bought S.A.B. Miller, the Mexican brewer. And they went in and cut costs by about 35%. They improved the margins at Modelo from like 15% to 25%. So when I've heard that InBev had announced this acquisition, I said, they must know what they're doing. And I took everything they publicized as what they could pull off and actually valued the synergy based on their projections. I came up with $14 billion for synergy. That's amazing, right? That's a lot of synergy. But they paid a $25 billion premium. This is why mergers fail. It's not because there isn't synergy and all this neat stuff. It's because if you pay too much, it doesn't matter how well thought through, how good the match is, it's not going to work. Is there an M&A class still at Stern? Right? If you sit in an M&A class, and I'm not critiquing the class, or maybe I am, think of how much time is spent on getting the right fit and putting the deal together and how little time is actually spent on the price paid on a merger. And you're very quickly going to see why the focus is in the wrong place in acquisitions. I'll make a statement, I'm willing to back it up. I don't care who you buy. If you get it at a bargain, it's a good acquisition. I don't care who you buy. But if you pay too high a price, it's a bad acquisition. Good and bad acquisitions are based on the price you pay, not how good the fit is. Yes?
So you say that, like, from a manager perspective, it would be ideal to do most of your acquisitions during a down market?
I'll go back. From a management perspective, internal growth should always trump external growth, right? Remember the old saying, your mom or your dad or somebody said, if you don't do the work, don't expect to get rewarded. In an acquisition, what are you doing? You're essentially bypassing. Don't worry, he's not hijacking the quizzes. He's just going to put them in alphabetical order for me to grade. Okay? Bypassing the building up of a business. Okay. If you look at companies trying to enter new business, there are two ways you can do it. You can do a big acquisition and enter, which is what Microsoft is trying with Activision. Or you can do what Microsoft did with the cloud business, where it built up its business from inside. I had much better expectations for that first, for the cloud business investment. I think the Activision, they can pull it off, but when you paid $75 billion upfront, you've raised the ante. You now have to deliver cash flows to justify the $75 billion, and you have to make above that. When you make big acquisitions of publicly traded companies, the dice are loaded against you because you paid that upfront price. You built in synergy expectations into the price, and now you've got to deliver even higher numbers to deliver excess returns for your investors. So the next big acquisition, there will be one next week, 2 weeks from now. Step back and take a look at who's buying who. Take managers at their word on synergy and say, what will that mean? But you're going to find yourself frustrated because a lot of the time they will talk about synergy, but there will be no specifics. So there's one final. Any questions on the Zoom? Okay. There's one final part of investment analysis that I want to talk about. Up till now, we've been pretty categorical, right? You've got to take a project has to have a positive net present value or an IRR that exceeds a hurdle rate for it to be a good project. I'm not going to abandon that rule, but there will be times where you might consider taking a project that looks like a bad project. This might seem like you're violating investment discipline, but let's talk about why that can happen. You've seen options and foundations. You've probably seen, right, call options, put options, usually in the context of buying those options on an options exchange or part of a bond in a convertible bond. But if you think about what options are essentially the right to do something. The key word is right, not an obligation. So you do it if it works out in your best interest and you walk away if you don't. And there are two types of options. A call option gives you the right to buy something at a fixed price, and a put option gives you the right to sell something at a fixed price. I'm not interested in revisiting that options as investment scenario, but I'm going to bring in options investment analysis and talk about why you might end up using option arguments to justify taking a bad investment. Let's take a project. It's a negative net present value project. It's on a technology that you have exclusive rights to. So today, what does the negative net present value say? You shouldn't take this project today. Don't make a leap from that to saying the exclusive rights I have to this project are worthless and give the rights away. And here's why. A project can have a negative net present value today, but if you have exclusive rights and you wait, it could become a good project. It might not, but it could, right? Why? Because the market could get bigger. The technology could change, your cost structure could shift. That's called the option to delay. And what it tells you is you can have a negative net present value project and the rights to that project can still be very valuable. Can you imagine if you'd valued the mRNA technology at Moderna in 2018, you projected out the market and you said, you know what? This market is too small. When will we ever need a vaccine on this scale? Let's sell it off for $100 million. History is full of businesses that have sold off valuable technologies because somebody was thinking just in current terms said, that's not worth much. That's an option to delay. Here's the second option. And this is where it can get really dangerous because it's a very alluring option. For the last 20 years, US and European companies have been entering China as a market, right? Big market, potentially huge growth. Many of these companies have taken those initial investments in China, even though that initial investment had a negative net present value. So Marriott, when it opened its first hotel in China, probably said, you projected their cash flows, probably wasn't even close to breaking even. You're saying, why would they then open the hotel? Because if the hotel worked, if it in fact caught on, think of the potentially large market you could get by expanding the rest of China. That's the option to expand. And I'll tell you why it's become more relevant now. The biggest trend in companies pushing business models is building a platform business, right? Everybody talks about platform business. You're saying, what's the value of platform? You have a lot of people on your platform, and to the degree that they are on your platform for a period and they're sticky, they stay on your platform, there might be other things you can do with them. I mean, let's take Facebook or Google. Right now, they have immense platforms, both companies. Right now, almost all of the money they make comes from one business, advertising. So almost everything Facebook makes, almost everything Google makes comes from advertising. I think for Google, it's 91%. For Facebook, it's 97%. So you could value Facebook and Google as advertising companies. But here's what you will miss in your intrinsic valuation. Right now, it might not be viable for them to actually do retailing or offer entertainment or news because they can't figure out a way to make money on their platform. But if they ever figured out how to do it, it could be potentially a huge value. So right now, the expectation is they can't do it. So when you do your DCF, you're being realistic saying, I don't think Facebook can convert its platform to a retailing platform. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't have value. The fact that it doesn't have value today doesn't mean it couldn't have value in the future. The option to expand is perhaps the most dangerous and most lucrative of all options. Lucrative because it can be upside, but dangerous because you can keep using this excuse over and over, right? For investing in platforms. I can't make money on it, but I'll figure out one of these days what to do. People selling platform technologies know this. And yesterday I was talking to a candy company that, you know, all of a sudden is caught up in wanting to create a platform. And I say, what exactly are you going to gather on this platform? They said, we're going to collect data on what types of candies our customers will buy. I say, okay, what do you plan to do with that? They said, maybe we can change. So in a sense, a conversation is starting, but I want them to think through what does it mean in terms of this. Is this option going to be worth billions? Is it worth hundreds of millions? Because that's really what should drive whether you invest in this platform. So that's the option to expand. And then there's a final option. It's the option to abandon. It is one of life's most valuable options. Because when you make an investment, you do all of your homework. You pick the investment because you think it's a good investment. A year later, could you look back and say, I wish I hadn't done that? Some of you have made your biggest investment already of your life so far, right? How much does this MBA cost you? So you're midway through and you say, when I entered, I thought I was going to do this. Now my mind's been changed. Your option to abandon might have been gone because NYU might have already, they're very good at collecting tuition ahead of time in case you change. Can you imagine if you had to pay tuition at the end of the semester? How many people would actually drop out midway through? The option to abandon is the option to walk away from your mistakes. And in investment analysis, here's how it shows up. Remember the Lowe's project? You invested $1 billion up front. What if 3 years into this project, you realize nobody's walking into your furniture stores? It'd be silly first to keep opening 10 more stores every year, right? Or 100 more stores. That plan is out of the window. But you might actually say, look, let's walk away from this business. It's the option to abandon. Now, I'm not going to go into the specifics of valuing these options, but they're dancing around in the background as you're doing your investment analysis saying, hey, look at me, because in a sense, even though the project is negative, that has a negative net present value, this option can be used to explain why you want to take the project. So let's start with the option to delay. As I said, I'm just going to give you a big picture perspective of how to think about these options. Whenever you think about options, I want you to think about this picture, because this is what characterizes options. This is a picture for a call option, right? Any type of call option. The significance is there's a strike price, and anything below the strike price, what you lose is fixed. That is what separates options from other assets, is basically your fixed losses if the outcome turns bad enough. But if you get upside, you get the potential upside. You're saying, how does this explain the option to delay? Right now, what did I say? This project has a negative net present value, right? Think of it as an out of the money option. Right now, this option, S is below K. It'd be crazy for you to exercise. But if you have the rights to this option or this project for the next 10 years, what could happen? S could change over time. Technology markets could change, and S could become greater than K. That's the option to expand. And anytime you have exclusive rights to a technology, exclusive rights to doing something, you got to think through not just what the project is worth today, but what's the option worth. Again, I told you companies often sell away valuable technologies for too little. A company called RCA, you heard of them? This, you know, it's still around, especially an old TV. It used to be a glorious brand name in the US, a lot of TVs made. In the early 70s, they came up with a product. I'll describe the product, and I don't even know whether many of you will recognize it, because many of you might not even. It was a box into which you put a tape, and you could watch things on TV, the very first VCR. Now, can you imagine being the project analyst in the very first VCR? You're saying, how many people are going to buy a product? We'll send a demo tape. Remember, there were no Blockbuster video rentals. So basically, when you did the project analysis, people said, the market is going to be tiny. There are very few people who want to watch this demo tape over and over again. It doesn't make sense to make the VCR today, which was actually the right decision at that point in time. But then they made their big mistake. They said, because the NPV is negative, somebody comes in and offers us money for this technology, we should sell it. And that's exactly what Panasonic did. They came to RCA and said, would you sell this technology? You can all see the finance guys in RCA laughing behind them. You know, these crazy guys didn't know what they're buying. Panasonic bought the technology from RCA. Sony was developing its own technology. It was called Betamax as opposed to, and they both hit the market and eventually became huge markets. In one of the great ironies, about 10 years later, RCA had to go back to Panasonic to license out the production of this technology. They'd basically given away almost for free. So something to think about when you see a product or a technology that's not viable today, or a drug that might not be viable today. If you have exclusive rights, there is an option there, and it's your obligation to think about how much is that option worth. So when you think about exclusivity, that's something to factor in. But the key is exclusivity. Just because you have an interesting technology or an interesting project is not enough if other people can do it, right? Because then there's no optionality. So you have to have some degree of exclusivity, either because the legal system protects you or because you're doing something that nobody else can do. So that's your option to delay and something to factor in when you look at projects, especially in businesses where there's a huge amount of uncertainty in the future. And this is the other place where once you start thinking in terms of options, your mindset has to shift. Up till now, whenever we've looked at risk in investment analysis, it's been a negative, right? Higher risk, higher discount rate, lower value, which makes sense. But once you think in terms of options, if you have the rights to do something, it's not viable now, guess what? Risk becomes your ally. Because you haven't taken the investment yet. You want a lot of uncertainty in this business for this investment that's right now a bad investment to become a good investment. The rights to a technology are more valuable in a business with a lot more risk than with a lot less risk. Kind of shifts your thinking on risk. Let's talk about the option to expand. Again, it's a call option. And here's the way to think about it. Remember the Marriott example I gave you? That first hotel has a negative net present value. That's bad, right? It's like taking an investment for less than you should, I mean, getting less in value than you're investing. But let's assume by taking that first investment, you get this right to do something else, which could be much bigger. In the case of China, let's assume if you don't open that first hotel, you will never be able to go out and expand big time because you don't know the Chinese market. You got to start somewhere. Think of it almost like a test market. The test market is going to lose you money. But why are you doing this? Because there's a potential to expand the rest of China. So here's how the option plays out. The investment you'll have to make to expand becomes the strike price. That's what you would have to do to expand. The cash flows you will get from expansion become something like the stock price. Right now, it doesn't make sense for you to expand because you don't know the market at all. It looks like a negative net present value project. But that, again, could change over time. This is a much, the Marriott example is a much more dangerous option than the example I gave you, the pharmaceutical company. Do you see why? Marriott goes out and opens his first hotel because it says, look, we don't know how the Chinese market works, how much people will pay for hotel rooms, how long they will stay, because we want to collect information. They collect information. But you know what a nightmare scenario is, right? While you're doing this, Hilton and Hyatt hire people to stand outside your hotel and watch what's happening. In other words, they let you collect the information. And just as you get ready to say, I'm going to open 500 more hotels in China, Hilton beats you to the punch. There is no exclusivity here. And because there's no exclusivity, doesn't mean there's no option value, but the option value becomes much smaller if you don't have exclusivity. In fact, anytime you have a conversation with anybody who uses the word option, ask them about exclusivity. In fact, I have a paper on my website that's, you know, the title says, opportunities are not options. There's a lot of people for the last 20 years have been using the fact there's a big market. Therefore, there's an option. The electric car market is huge, but just the fact that you're in the electric car business doesn't give you optionality unless you tell me that you have some degree of exclusivity here, a technology that nobody else has, a battery that can work for 1,000 miles. That will give you an optionality, but don't mistake opportunities for options. Which brings me to the option to abandon. Yes. Yeah, think of it as a continuum, right? A legal patent gives you complete exclusivity. Okay? First mover advantage. So if you think about every strategic competitive advantage, first mover, we have better technology. It falls in a continuum between no exclusivity to complete exclusivity. So one way to think about it is the further towards total exclusivity, or the stronger your competitive advantage, the barriers to entry, the more optionality there is. The weaker those competitive advantages, the less optionality there is. Every technology company out there is implicitly making an option argument. So when you talk to their CEO, say, hey, your company doesn't look like it's worth much based on your cash flows. Their argument is there are so many big things we can do. And this is a way of holding them accountable, saying, okay, so what, but what makes you special? Right? Everybody says ride sharing is going to be big, but what makes you special? Because that's what gives the option value. Which brings me to the option to abandon. As I said, often you go into projects, you've done all your homework. It doesn't mean the project is going to be a good project because things can change. So BP, when it entered into that joint venture with, was it Gazprom, or probably did the present value of the cash flows, they said, this is a good project, let's go in. Now you can jump on them saying that was a terrible decision. You should have seen what was coming. But obviously in April of 2022, you look back and say, I wish I hadn't done that. In fact, every company that's abandoning its Russian operations, not suspending them, like McDonald's is suspending them, is abandoning it, in a sense is saying, hey, that investment in hindsight was not the right investment. The option to abandon measures how much value there is to being able to walk away. It's the only real option. The options I'm describing are called real options. It's a put option. And here's how it plays out. You run the project, if it's a good project, but there's a point at which you say, if I keep running the project, I'm going to be throwing good money after bad. Think of what you will get by liquidating the liquidating the project as the abandonment cost. So essentially you abandon the project and you walk away because you feel by staying in the project, you're essentially going to keep losing more and more money. You're not going to get your initial investment back. It's not like somebody's lined up there saying, hey, you made a mistake. I'm sorry for you. Take the $1 billion back. But you're trying to ask, should I keep going with this project? So I'll give you a framework that might help you think about that choice of what do we do about projects that go bad? Because in every company, in every business, there will be investments which don't measure up to what you thought they would do at the start. So if you think in terms of what we're talking about here, we're talking about, now you've heard the term flexibility thrown around a lot in the last 2 years, how it's good for business to be flexible and adaptable. What I hear is the option to abandon, to be able to walk away from your mistakes, and what does it cost you? So if you look at COVID, it was a classic test of which companies have more valuable options to abandon, are able to walk away from the mistakes easier than others. COVID hits in February and March. If you're Marriott or you're Hilton, you can't walk away from your mistakes because you have too much investment in physical assets. In contrast, if you're Airbnb, you're far less invested. It's easier for you to walk away from your mistakes. I'm not saying that makes the Airbnb model better than the Marriott model, but it makes it more flexible. If nothing else, COVID, I think, reminded businesses of the value of being flexible. Of not, because in the 20th century, you know what the rule was? Build up huge infrastructure to keep the competition up. So the automobile companies would go in and build, you know, these huge assembly lines with cost advantages. And that was their way for keeping the competition. It worked really well, right? Because if you think about new automobile companies that got started in the 20th century in the US after GM, Ford, and Chrysler, almost every single one crashed and burned because they couldn't go against it. In contrast, what did Tesla do when they needed to get to 5,000 cars a week? They built them in tents. Remember that about 3 years ago? They'd set up tents because they wanted to get, they didn't have enough assembly lines. And the other automakers laughed at them, said, this is a crazy way to run an automobile business. But here's the plus. I mean, you might have inefficiencies, but when COVID hit, Tesla was able to scale down production much more quickly and not face the same cost. So an option to abandon is basically a plea for, hey, build in escape hatches. when you make these huge investments, don't say, look, I want to show you how much conviction I have in this investment, so I'll have no escape. It's a terrible way to do things in a world where everything can shift on you in 6 months or a year, year and a half. Option to delay, option to expand, option to vend. For the moment, I just want to leave that as kind of qualitative factors. At some point in time, you might say, how do I put a number on that? How much is flexibility worth? And if in my valuation class, I do make it more explicit, but no, the problem though is that requires some degree of entanglement with option pricing models. And I don't want to go there right now. We have too much on our plate. But at some point, I think there's a value, even if you're never going to trade an option, to understanding what drives the value of an option. Which leaves me with, during 2020, I wrote a series of posts on which companies were doing the best and which ones were hurt the most. And one of the tables I put out was I broke down companies based on how much capital they needed to invest to get their revenue. So think about, you know, the higher the sales to capital ratio, the less capital you're investing. So it's less, more capital intensive, less capital intensive businesses. And I computed how they were doing during COVID. No surprise here. The more capital intensive companies were, lower sales to capital ratio, the worse they did during COVID, because they were hurt a lot more than companies were able to skate through because they had much higher revenues for every dollar of capital invested. So this is just a measure of capital intensity. The lowest are the most capital intensive, the highest are the least capital intensive. And it's a shortcut on flexibility. Yeah.
That's,
in fact, you can be flexible. And so this is investing flexibility. On financing, you see how flexibility pays out? When you borrow more money, you made yourself more inflexible. So you can talk about tax benefits as we were, but more debt-laden companies. And in dividends, do you see it play out as well? If you commit to paying big dividends, you've taken away flexibility. So you can take investment, financing, dividends, and talk about flexibility on all three dimensions. And flexibility to the degree that, and I'm not saying it's a pure good, right? You give up something by not borrowing money. You give up something by not building bigger plants. You give up something by not paying out dividends, but you gain the flexibility in the trade-off. Which brings me to my final point, which is, now, up till now, every project we looked at was a new project. We start with a fresh slate, which is nice, right? You get to pick whether to invest in the project or not. But let's face it, if you're in a company, most of the projects you have are existing projects. And part of you say, there's some cost, nothing I can do about them. But that is not true. Because in every existing project, you can stop and ask, should I keep with this project? So think of that as continuing the project. Should I sell the project? Should I abandon the project? Or should I invest even more in this project on every existing project? It's a lot of work, but companies need to think through this because those four choices stay in play. And here's what, you know, so one reason you look at past projects is you want to punish people. Right, because all these people push projects. So that's, I think, a lesser factor. But part of the reason you look back is you ask yourself, you know, what kinds of mistakes did we make? And maybe we can avoid those mistakes in the future. I'll tell you one of the most revealing things you get when you look at past projects is how much bias there is in your investment process. You see why? Because when you look at a project, you project out earnings, revenues, cash flows, right? Then you look back. You're going to be wrong every single project. But if you have no bias, what should you find? On some of your projects, you overestimated revenues and cash flows. And on some of your projects, you underestimated. Let's say on every project you look at, you've realized you're wrong, but you're always wrong in the same direction. You have a problem. The problem is not that people can't do revenues and cash flows. The problem is the people assessing the projects have so much bias. They've decided already, they're using the investment analysis as a way of pushing a decision they've already made. So when you look back at projects, it's not punitive. It's really to assess how badly broken is our investment process and what do we need to do to reduce the bias. You can never eliminate the bias, to reduce the bias in that process. So when you do postmortems, you can compare, and I don't think companies do this enough. Because remember that table you did for Lowe's? Let's say Lowe's goes out and opens the furniture stores. I think Lowe's in year five and year six and year seven should be looking at the actual cash flows and asking, what can I learn from these cash flows about this project and what can I do differently? So as I said, there are, you know, when you look at mistakes, you know, part of the reason you're off is just things you can't control. Macro factors that move against chance. And part of it is bias. And I can live with screwed up analysis, but I can't live with biasedness. Here's why. Let's say you're just wrong in every project and you take hundreds of projects. You know what's going to bail you out? The law of large numbers, because some projects you're going to overestimate. So mistakes are easier to work with as a company than bias. And that's why I think when you see bias, you got to figure out, where's that bias coming from? Should we have somebody else analyzing the projects? Because if you don't do that, you're going to end up with a lot of bad projects in your books. And it's going to be almost pre-designed, because that's the way you've set up your system. So as I said, there are four choices you often have with existing projects. The first is you liquidate the project. When did you do that? If you figure out that the future cash flows on this project are going to be negative, might as well just walk away. Even if you get nothing back, your capital is gone. If your expected cash flows have a present value which is less than zero, you just walk away from the project, shut everything down. If you can salvage something, if you can terminate the project and sell the assets, the threshold becomes a little higher. As long as the present value of your cash flows is greater than that salvage value, you keep the project going. But if it's less, you'll shut the project down. It gets even better if there's somebody willing to buy the project from you. In which case, all you have to do is make sure the present value of your cash flows are greater than what you can get from selling the project. If not, you're going to sell the project. But there's a final option to consider. Maybe there's something you can fix in this project that'll make it become a better project by investing more. It's kind of dicey because the project hasn't worked out. You're saying, should I throw more money in? Sometimes that option to expand the project might be viable, because what you invest to expand can be less than what you get back. So I'm going to use an example. And for those of you who've been to the Disneyland in Anaheim, the example should be familiar. The original Disneyland was just the first Magic Kingdom, was built on in Anaheim. That's 1957, 58. And in 2001, Disney, so if you've ever been to the Anaheim Disney World, the Magic Kingdom's one side, there's this big brick area in the front. And on the other side of the brick area in 2001, Disney built a new theme park called California Adventure. It was very different from the existing theme parks, where it's amusement park rides, essentially a very different, more like Six Flags than a typical Disney theme park. And when they built it, they spent a lot of money. They invested about $1.5 billion. And when they did their initial assessment, they estimated that 60% of the tourists, because they're two separate tickets. So for Disney at that time, they were off and you could buy a joint ticket, but it was more expensive. They estimated that 60% of the people coming to Magic Kingdom would walk across the brick area and come into California Adventure. And based on that 60%, it looked like a good project, and they took it. A few years later, when they look back, they realized they had a problem. About 30 to 40% of the people were coming across. The actual cash flows were well below what they thought they would. In fact, their actual estimated cash flows were about 50 million instead of the 100 million they originally projected. So the theme park is not doing as well as they thought to, and they faced three choices. One is they could shut down California Adventure, convert it back to parking lots. Disney needs a lot of parking. Second, continue with the status quo. They're not losing money. They're still making $50 million a year. And they had a third choice. They could invest another $600 million trying to make California Adventure more kid-friendly. The reason they weren't getting people coming across is if you have a three-year-old or four-year-old, I think the minimum height at that point in time was 45 inches for kids to get on California Adventure rides. So you weren't bringing a three or four-year-old. What were you going to do? Leave them on the side and go on the ride by yourself? So you could spend another $600 million making it kid-friendly. So I looked at all three options. The first is, I said, if they just continue, the value of the cash flows are going to get a $50 million a year growing at the inflation rate. So the present value is $1.1 billion. Disappointing relative to the original idea, but still, you're not going to walk away from $1.1 billion. Abandoning, As I said, you could convert to parking lots, charge people $25 a day to park. Maybe that's worth $500 million. $1.1 billion is higher than. So if I ask you, should you abandon or continue, you're going to say continue. But there's a third option. You invest another $600 million. Let's say that pushes up the cash flow from 50 to 80 million. It becomes an incremental cash flow assessment, right? You invest $600 million. You get back $662 million. That's a present value of the incremental $30 million cash flow. The third choice seems to dominate the first two. If you didn't have the third choice, you just continue as is. But given that third choice, that makes the most sense. I don't know what Disney actually did, but if you've been to California Adventure, you know how much money Disney has invested in California Adventure. They have that Star Wars land, an entire, like a half an acre or an acre of cars where you can, essentially they've invested huge amounts. So for better or worse, they've decided that the third option is the best. I hope they did their own homework before they did that. Because otherwise you could be throwing good money after bad and your cash flow stay at 50 minutes. So that's the end of packet one. When we come back, we're going to talk about the next part of corporate finance. So please bring your second packets with you because that's what we will start on Wednesday. See you then.